The Titfield Thunderbolt is one of my favourite films, and I'm so chuffed to have been able to work on the recent train pack we made at work in conjunction with Studio Canal and the 70th anniversary of the film. Ever since I first saw it, I've always wondered how I would go about remaking the film in the modern era. A couple of warnings. If you haven't seen the film, it's been out for 70 years. What are you playing at? Go and watch it now. Another warning for Grisers. Before you get too excited about exactly which locomotive I would bring out of retirement to play Thunderbolt, or who I would cast with the millions of pounds of studio money I would have been given, this feels more about the differences in theme and storytelling between 1953 and now, as well as the historical context of the film. So, sticking to a decent feature film length of under 2 hours, what would change? Part 1. Historical setting and knowing your enemies. Taking the history point first, the film was made in 1952. To put it in context with some relevant dates, that's 5 years after BR was formed. It predated the modernisation plan by 3 years, and the Beeching Report didn't come out until 11 years later. Monkton Combe Station had closed to passengers in 1925, well before the nationwide cull that the film predicted. In fact, the closing of the branch line in the film is more reflective of the tidying up that went on in the immediate aftermath of the formation of BR, where duplicate lines were shut to passengers. Anyone who has seen the Railway Roundabout videos may recall that it begins with the termination of services on an old LNWR line in the Welsh Valleys. However, looking back now, it would be rather dramatic to bring the events of the film forward by over a decade, and have the villagers make their stand against the malevolent characters of the government, with ministers such as Ernest Marples and his crony Richard Beeching forming primary antagonists. If we take a more modern British film such as Richard Curtis's The Boat That Rocked, you have the stick-in-the-mud government official cracking down on pirate radio and dispatching his operative, Commander Norrington, to see that the Enterprise is sunk, literally. The original film has the villainous Pierce and Crump capitalising on the railway's closure. They didn't actually cause the closure by BR, though they do offer an alternative transport service at the hearing. Nowadays, would it do to have the two groups of antagonists operating independently? Or could we take some real-life inspiration from the fact that Marples employed his own company to build the motorway network here? What if our nasty minister character had a personal stake in seeing the railway fail? Perhaps he wants to use the trackbed for his new proposed highway, as was later seen on the Ashburton line when the preservationists were forced to truncate their railway at Buckfast Lee when the Devon Expressway was built. If he's already promised the road-building contract to a friend or relative, that gives him the motive to dispatch someone to disrupt the railway's operations. So what we now have is much more of a mouse-that-roared underdog story, with the whimsical villagers throwing two fingers up at losing their public transport link. There would be another aspect of moving the timeline in that Thunderbolt's anachronistic appearance would be even more stark against mainline diesels and electrics, as well as the cars and vehicles of the late 1950s and early 1960s. The original film was still firmly in the steam era, but this would be a classic old technology defeats new story. Perhaps not very realistic, but audiences tend to like it. Part 2. Sam shot first. Since Pierce and Crump are clearly bad, in inverted commas, people, on first watch it might seem like they always intended to wreck the villagers' train. But the escalation of hostilities happens after the famous duel. Taking this scene, Pierce and Crump have disabled a scrap truck in the path of the train. Their intention is to delay the train and make Sam and friends lose face and therefore ensure their monopoly on transport will go ahead. However, it is Reverend Samuel Weech who, quite quickly, decides to ram the truck out of the way in order to keep to the timetable. Pierce and Crump clearly didn't expect this violence from a clergyman, hence their horror and protestations when one of their assets is destroyed. Harry shows up on his steamroller, and a key thing here is that they try to pay him to block the train, not hit it. And Harry actually turns down the money they offer him because he doesn't want to upset Joan. Sam once again takes the initiative and rams into Harry, understandably causing Harry to fly into a rage and hit the train with his roller, shortly followed by his pride and joy, and presumably his source of income, being shoved off the track, clearly damaged. Harry later tries to disable the train in revenge by sabotaging the water tower, and eventually wrecks the train using his roller. The question here is, in remaking the film, would Sam still shoot first? There's a parallel in the famous Han Solo versus Greedo scene in Star Wars, where it was altered in subsequent versions to make Han fire in self-defense rather than killing Greedo in cold blood. Do we lose sympathy for protagonists who throw the first punch? Would the duel scene be reframed so that the antagonists try to damage the train on purpose and the villagers lash out in return. Part 3. Chekhov's locomotive. Thunderbolt as a character does make an appearance early in the film, both in the painting at Sam's home and as a backdrop at the inquiry. This means it is not a total deus ex machina swooping in to save the day in the third act, but it's never directly referenced or talked about early on. Now, I'm not saying modern audiences are slower on the uptake, but I do think is that people love a callback, and they love to feel like they spotted the solution before the main characters did. Therefore, I think we need to have at least a conversation about Thunderbolt earlier on. For example, Sam could ask the squire if his dad ever drove it, with the response that his great-grandfather did. Or perhaps two characters are clambering on it at the museum and trying to imagine what it would have been like to master such a machine, perhaps even referencing the inadequate brakes or reversing gear that will become an issue during the film's climax. Whilst Thunderbolt doesn't fall from heaven, one character who appears out of nowhere at just the right moment is Bishop Ollie Matthews, someone who has never been mentioned up to that point. I've always felt that there was something missing here, as Sam's incredulous comment of "the Bishop of where?" and the mention of Welchester makes it seem as if a previous conversation has been cut out of the script during a rewrite. This last-minute addition of a suitable fireman just when they needed it is somewhat incongruous in a modern film, and I feel that Ollie needs to have made an appearance at some other point in the story. There needs to be an established relationship between Ollie and Sam, perhaps through their joint love of railways. Or maybe Ollie congratulates Sam on the acquisition of the branch line over the phone, and Sam invites him down for the inspection, not realising he'll need to ask for Ollie's help. Both Ollie and Thunderbolt need to be more defined as examples of Chekhov's gun, the keys to the hero's success that will come in handy in the third act. Part 4. Redemption. Harry, Harry, Harry. Both the saboteur and saviour of the railway, Harry wrecks the train in revenge for the damage to his engine, but also agrees to lend his driving chain to use as a coupling when Joan promises to marry him. Possibly because of runtime limits, possibly due to pacing, Harry is never really fleshed out. But what audiences are now used to seeing is the redemption arc of a secondary antagonist, for example Yondu coming to the rescue in the final act of Guardians of the Galaxy. With this in mind, how should Harry change his mind? Would he feel guilt over the destruction of the train? Should there be more dialogue between him and Joan, with them quarrelling over having picked opposing sides? And the engagement? Would there now be less of a transaction, as in Joan offers a lifetime of marriage in exchange for Harry saving the railway, and more of a reconciliation, where Harry sees the error of his ways and makes the decision to appeal to Joan by helping the railway? Part 5. Climax and Epilogue. Like so many films of its era, the end comes swiftly for the Titville Thunderbolt. Though not as dramatic and explosive as the end of Oh Mr. Porter, the eventual success of the villagers is by a fluke, and not really down to anything they've done deliberately. In fact, if things had gone to plan, they wouldn't have been granted a light railway order, so they've failed upwards. Whilst this is the joke in the film, this accidental success is quite unusual now, where often the main characters have to try really hard to succeed, or somehow outsmart their opponents. The climax build-up is a montage of Thunderbolt driving along the line after the coupling calamity, but there isn't really a final action sequence or big exertion from anyone, apart from poor Ollie, who isn't the man he was. Does there need to be more of an epic finale? Finally, the villagers have succeeded and there is a wild whistle-blowing bonanza to celebrate, then fade to black. This abrupt end is typical for films of the time. Just look at something like Hell Drivers, where the end of the film comes less than 2 minutes after the victory. But these days, people like a bit of resolution for the main plot, as well as the various character arcs. But what studios really like is keeping the door open for a sequel. So here's a couple of pitches. First, the Serenity ending. For whatever reason, the villagers scrape through and get approved. Cue mass whistling celebration. Then we cut to a normal morning on the railway. Thunderbolt is in steam, the tramcar has been repaired in the barn, passengers are smiling. Sam opens the regulator and the train pulls out of the station. There is a loud clunk as something falls off Thunderbolt, and Sam's face turns from happiness to shock. Cut to black, credits roll. Or, if you want more, the Netflix ending. Thunderbolt pulls out of Titfield Station, just as a vehicle pulls up into the car park and a man wearing a coat and hat gets out. Pan up to the shadowy figure, revealing it to be Ernest Marples himself. Dun dun dun! The stage is set for a sequel. Enjoy. Epilogue. How would it work as a miniseries? Some time ago, I worked on a pitch for a miniseries that focused on building a new structure or vehicle every episode. The pitch went round a few channels before fizzling out, but one key bit of feedback we got was from Netflix, who specifically said they weren't looking for shows where you could quite happily watch only one episode. They were only commissioning series where all the episodes led directly into each other, with overarching narratives spanning multiple shows. Therefore, only watching one episode out of sequence would be pointless, as you'd start with no context for what was happening and end with no resolution. Say you split the Titfield story into a small series, perhaps six episodes. How would you break up the story, and how would you leave audiences wanting more between the episodes? Hope you've enjoyed this little digression. It's been on my mind for a while, so I just wanted to share it with you. Thanks very much for listening, and bye for now.